You are listening to episode 281 of the Game Deflators Podcast. Here on the Game Deflators Podcast, we like to talk about games we recently picked up, games we're currently playing, and we can't even manage on this week's Inflation Deflation Challenge. So this week I am joined by Darren Hupke of 32-Bit Library to talk video games, talk about 32-Bit Library, and do a review of The City of Lost Children on the PlayStation 1.
Obscure one. That was a deep cut.
Yeah, dude. When I sent that to you, you're like, what game are we playing? City of Lost Children? I don't know. Like that.
That was complete. I mean, you mentioned wanting to do like a PlayStation game. I'm like, oh, okay. And in my brain, there's... what, 1200 plus almost 1300 games. I'm thinking it's something, probably something I'm familiar with. City of Lost Children, while I am familiar with like the source material and everything a bit, it is definitely an obscure and interesting game to pick.
For sure. So this week we're going to have a few articles we'll talk about, and then we'll dive into our recent pickups and what we're currently playing. The first thing here is articles. So is 2024 Microsoft's year? Do parents need more security features? And a surprising video game character has been named the most iconic. So we'll get into that a little bit later, as well as that inflation deflation of the week. But first, I will pass it over to you after I tell people where to find us, because I almost forgot that. I did last time. You can find us on thegameinflators.com, our currently up-to-date website. You can find us on YouTube. You can find us on social media, at Game Deflators, on X, at The Game Deflators, on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads. You'll listen to a podcast application. Leave us a 5-star review. We'd greatly appreciate it. And then, Darren, where can folks find you?
Social media-wise, like at Darren Hupke is what I typically use. It's usually not taken. There's not a lot of Darren Hupkes, I feel, trying to have a social media presence. So that's Instagram, Blue Sky, and Threads. I bailed out on Twitter or X with my personal account. I don't know why. I think I was doing some personal and political thing or whatever, maybe. I have no idea, really. But I kept at 32-Bit Library available there for marketing and kind of connection reasons. So that's on X, that's on Instagram, that's on Threads, and that's on Blue Sky. So at Darren Hupke, at 32-Bit Library, both two handles available.
Awesome stuff. Yeah, so definitely follow Darren on there. And you said you had a podcast as well. Is there any separate handles for that?
I decided not to do that because I've done a non-gaming related one called Complete Discography. And I made a handle for that, and trying to like manage like multiple and try and build an audience and things like that. I'm just a guy trying to have some fun. So like I'll post about them on my personal accounts as well. And if you want to interact with me, like I'm the guy hosting and running them. So you can just find me at Darren Hupke and you can read that. So yeah, the gaming one is new. So that is still just get in touch with me directly to chat or talk or, being interactive with that. But that's Pixels and Polygons is the name of that new one.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the logo on that one. That's a good one.
Yeah.
So I'll pass it to you first for any recent pickups that you had.
Yeah, I'm a pretty controlled spender. I want to buy, and I just wish listed a few things before coming over here, but Hi-Fi Rush, now that that's available to me as a biased PlayStation fan, it's now available for purchase, even though people who are Xbox fans have been able to play it for a long time. That I really want to pick up. It looks rad. There's the Dragon's Dogma 2. I want to pick that up. That looks really good as well. I'm trying to control and pace it. I'm currently in the midst of the Final Fantasy VII Rebirth train. 91 hours in, I'm like almost done with chapter 12. So I feel like I'm close, but I don't want to start or buy anything until I kind of finish that out. Technically, I abandoned Persona 3 Reload to start Final Fantasy, and I'm like 60 hours into that one. On top of discovering Balatro, if you've heard of that poker roguelike game that was insanely addictive. I'm also dabbling in that, as I play, but no recent pickups as I'm trying to just finish and wrap those things up before making that next purchase.
I think it's actually kind of funny. You said you abandoned Persona. Ryan also abandoned Persona as his like new games resolution a couple years ago. I think it's Persona 4. That hit hard here in abandoning Persona
yeah.
again.
Well, I fully intend to go back to it. Like I remember exactly where I'm at in the plot. I love the combat. It's not as like loved per se at this point. It was like Persona 5 was for me, but it's still like really entertaining, really good game. I was just hoping to roll credits on that before Rebirth came out, but Rebirth in my mind, just because of my love for Final Fantasy 7, that was always going to be a day one play no matter what was happening. So it caused me to pause when I typically would have just waited for any other game. I would have been like, hey, even if I'm really looking forward to you, let me finish what I'm playing now. I'm pretty good at controlling myself that way these days.
Yeah, not so much on my end. So for my recent pickups, I ended up getting Tactics Ogre Reborn. Ooh. Now, yeah, I know, that's a good one, right? Yeah. So main reason behind, I'm like, man, I could buy the PS1 versions of this and Super Nintendo, or I could just get something on PS5 and play Tactics Ogre and enjoy it for $30, I think it was, or $25. But that game, I think, came out like 40. So I held off, I waited a couple years and then bought it. But now I'm eyeing like other games I'm probably not going to play for years to come. So that's where things sit for me in terms of pickups. And then what I'm currently playing, I'm still playing Tales of Symphonia on the PS3. So yes, I did avoid playing it on the GameCube so I could play it on the PS3. I like it. So I haven't had any major updates since the last episode. I got past the first area in Tethiala, and then I've gone to the next city, basically. Like, that's what's going on. And we're trying to figure out a cure for Colette, for those that have been keeping up. And then the other game that we're playing right now, my wife and I are playing Liar Princess and the Blind Prince. So I don't know if you're familiar with that one.
No.
I'll show you after we record. So that one in particular is kind of like a storybook style game. It's about 4.5 hours in length total. It takes place over 6-7 chapters. It's like a platform adventure style game where you play as... Well, it starts off with a story of a prince who goes into the forest and hears this singing, and he listens and he applauds and whatnot. Turns out the singing is a wolf that sings to try and get her prey, right? Mm. So because the boy applauds, she falls in love with the boy, super happy. She sings for him all the time. But at some point, the boy says, oh, I want to go up and see who it is that's singing. And the wolf swipes and blinds him. And then her, feeling bad for doing this, is now trying to lead him to a witch's hut to be able to remove his blindness. The only way she's able to do that is by going to the witch first, who then turned the wolf into a princess but took away her singing voice as like the caveat for becoming a princess. And then in times of like moonlight or anything like that hitting her, she turns back into a wolf. So that's the general premise of the story, but it's very storybook-like. It's got a lot of, it feels more hand-drawn. So when you look at the game, it's like that scratch type art, you know, whereas it's not like super crisp and clean. Which I like. It's actually kind of cool. It's just like that comic book style art. It's got that sepia type filter on there in some instances of a book. So you got like this nice brown paper page that kind of opens up like a storybook and tells a story. And so it's a lot of storytelling components with some platforming and puzzle built in. Platforming puzzle, not that great because it's just super simple stuff. Mm-hmm. You're really going in for more of the story in this aspect.
Sounds cool.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, I'll show you the game afterwards. But it... it's got a release on, I think, the PS4 and the Switch, if I recall. It's gotten expensive, too. So I picked up, like, the collector's edition. I had, like, a little hardcover book and things of that nature. It's going for, like, $300 new.
Oh, wow.
And then you can pick up the normal version for, like, $30, I think. Hmm. So that was one of those, like, random Amazon buys, kind of what we were saying, wishlisting stuff. Just like, that looks interesting. Let me just buy that.
Now, was it $300 due to like demand now, or that's actually the original like?
No, it was like $80 when I bought it. I don't even think it was $80. I think it was like $50. I think it had dropped in price. Okay. Yeah, so it was one of those. I think it's what it comes down to. I think it's obscurity, right? Like we
probably
see a
low
lot of
print
games.
Run, and but then when critical or buzz happens about it, and it's already been released, like they're not going back into that well or anything to produce more.
Yeah, exactly, and especially with the special edition copies too, right? So like you can keep releasing all these digital copies of things, but or continually releasing physical copies, but when you start talking about the hardcover book and all these other things that are built into this overall package, it's a nice like collector's edition. Hmm. So, yeah, I'll show you that. I don't know if I have the full box downstairs, but I will show you the actual like case and everything. It's pretty cool. So that's it for my currently playing. So let's dive into 32-bit library. What do you got going on?
Yeah, I'm actively working on the fourth volume now, which will be the first book that covers multiple publishers. So 1, 2, and 3 were all specifically devoted to Capcom, Namco, and Konami's games because they just had enough titles independently to kind of make, you know, a meaty book out of it and everything. I knew I wanted the next book to have Square's games, like the Squaresoft PS1 games, But then when I went and looked at how many they released, it was like 20 some odd titles by themselves. And so I didn't, especially after the Konami book having like a little over 50 games, I didn't want to have like a book half the size like on the shelf next to it. And so I'm mentally just trying to keep like a 50 game sweet spot to kind of like fill the like future volumes and stuff. So with Square, I decided to bundle in Enix Working Designs and Atlas games into it. And so that's now a 58 game book. It will be bigger than the Konami book. So my goal to have it not be smaller, ballooned into being much bigger than the last one. That'll be the biggest one so far. But I've got about 18 more games to play through to like for like the screenshot capturing work. And then I'll do like the write-ups for those games afterwards. But I've done, you know, three quarters of it at this point. Gotten some of the guest contributions so far from a couple of the folks contributing. Jason Dvorak, who's been helping me since the first volume from Game Rave TV. He's already sent me his stuff. And so I'll have stuff coming from John Linneman, Audie Sorley, and Kurt Collada. He, you know, runs Hardcore Gaming 101 and has written a ton of like game books on his own. It's awesome that he's contributed as much as he has. So, Volume 4 in production. That's what I'm currently handling.
Sounds good. Dude, I'm actually really excited about that specifically because you got the Working Designs in there. Yeah. There's a lot of great games that people just don't know about from that period of time or just super obscure. I think, is it Cardia of the Lost World? I think that might be a Working Designs mm-hmm. game, if I recall. And I beat that one last year. That was my new games resolution that I played. And then you've got games like Alundra again that are like super obscure titles, so
yeah,
things like that are gonna be super cool to just cover in general. And I like the fact that it's a nice meaty book too.
I mean that Cartia has the Yoshitaka Amano like cover art too, which is really cool. Just for like Final Fantasy fans, they'll know the name or see notice his style and everything. But that always stood out. That, I mean, it was a fun game, but that's probably the coolest part of the package is that, like, you know, if you see the game case in person, the reflective kind of like printed material and that really cool cover just kind of stands out. I love that.
Yeah. Who's are you able to say who's writing your Star Ocean 2 piece?
I wrote that one. Yeah, I wrote that one myself. I would love if I had a lot more people interested to like writing the games independently. But the bonus contributions I've been getting are, people wanting to write like original essays or things about like other background things, which is totally cool because it just adds more flavor to the book itself. So, 90% of the games, like I'm writing just independently myself. So it's daunting, but then it's really cool when it's all done realizing like I wrote 10,000 words in that book. That's like a short novel, and now I'm adding up 3 volumes, 4 volumes together. Like I could have written Harry Potter, and
you got three more books than you can.
It's just been just kind of cool to see that come along. But yeah, writing all of it independently, Star Ocean 2, it's cool, and I think it came at the right time because I just played the re-release of it, that remastered one, and got the platinum trophy and grinded that out in December of the end of last year and everything. So I got refreshed and reminded of how fun that game was already.
How'd you like the new version?
I loved it. I think that it was just the right mix of updates and the right like quality of life improvements to what was already there. Like it felt familiar enough, but then had such a nice like facelift to it as well that it was that modern like, yeah, I don't know. It was just that right balance because of what you expect from a modern game, but still wanting like a retro like themed or a classic inspired game and all that stuff. So
yeah, Star Ocean 2 and Chrono Cross are definitely from the PS1 era my like number 1 and 2 games all time.
Nice. I haven't gotten to Chrono Cross yet from like a coverage standpoint, so I'm really looking forward to replaying that. I probably won't play the entire game, but just getting a feel for it, getting a taste for it, and diving.
Well, they remastered that one too, I think, right? Chrono Cross, I think it's a PlayAsia title.
Yeah, from what I understand, that's just essentially the exact same game, just available now like replaying. So it's like emulating just that original version. I think the graphical facelift is just more of like a, hey, we can bump up the internal resolution. It wasn't like new assets or anything per se, like Star Ocean was.
No, and that's what I meant, like a touch up, essentially. Like remaster, yeah, in that sense. I definitely have to get a hard copy of that. That's one that I've been trying to get my wife to play for a long time, because she was playing through the Final Fantasy games for quite a bit. I'm like, you've got to play Chrono Cross. Like, that to me is, a lot of people will say, oh, Chrono Trigger is so much better, but the musical scores on Chrono Cross to me are just like above and beyond anything else that has been released by Square. Maybe Final Fantasy X might be a close second for me, but yeah, I could listen to that OST so many times in a row. Like, it's insane. I used to work to it Like I just have it play in the background at work and just kind of listen and go through the flow of things.
That's cool. So, yeah. I want my wife to play Chrono Cross as well. She's currently replaying through Chrono Trigger right now. So I'm hoping that if she manages to finish it, you know, like, hey, like go into Chrono Cross. Cause I've actually never finished Chrono Cross personally. So I'd be totally down with just being able to see her play it and pop in to like, you know, see the plot and kind of get the updates from her just to see what she would do. I've been playing that on the Polymega. I just recently got that in. I think I was telling you about that before.
I don't think so.
It's a retro system. It's an all-in-one system. It physically has like a pre-installed hard drive that's not very big, but you can install like an SSD to it. But I guess to dumb it down the simplest of ways, it's like an iTunes for retro gaming. So it's all modular. It comes just with a CD drive on it. So PS1, Saturn, Sega CD, TurboGrafx, like any like CD-based game older than PS1 is likely compatible with it. But you put the disc in and it will rip it to its internal hard drive. You can play it off the disc, but you can also remove the disc, put it back in your collection, peek it on your shelf and like not worry about the condition of it, and then play it like off of it itself. But they sell like modular attachments so you can put Nintendo 64 cartridges in, NES, SNES, Genesis, like all those types of things and put them into it. So I got that and that's where I installed Chrono Trigger onto. And that's where my wife's been playing it. And so Chrono Cross can be on the same system with the same controller, HDMI output. It's just a really cool thing. It's kind of a pricey. It's like $400 or $500, but for an all-in-one type modular evolving like retro gaming system, it gets a huge recommendation for me for sure.
Nice. I'll have to look into that. So I have Retron 5 is the closest thing I would have to anything like that, and that's good enough, I guess, for me in a way. Just it doesn't have N64, which is obviously a big downside, but to be able to upscale a lot of those older games and get rid of scan lines and things like that has been pretty cool in general. So I'm a huge proponent of those types of consoles, specifically when they can, you know, amplify the quality of game that you're playing and just get it to that next level on a cheaper basis and having to like repurchase everything, you know, when they're remastering stuff. So that's pretty cool. Okay, so what about this podcast? You want to go into some deeper details on what's happening there with the podcast?
Yeah. I listen to gaming podcasts. I mean, I listen to a lot of podcasts, but sometimes in my commute to work, like one might end and instead of starting another episode up with like 20 minutes to go in the drive, like I'm kind of in a limbo. So like, it's always been in the back of my mind, like I'd want to do a short form podcast of something. And then, I'd missed doing this gaming podcast years ago that I used to do with a friend. And I realized like, why not just have, like a short form gaming podcast. So that's like the whole goal is just, I sit down with a guest, we answer one question or one prompt, you know, we just share our ideas or thoughts about that one question. I kind of mash two different people answering the same question together in an episode and try and keep it around 30 minutes. But the prompts or the questions, you know, will evolve over time. Like I might revisit the same question with a guest or with a different guest than who answered the first time. But the goal is just to like that podcast, you can listen in between things, or, you know, if you have just a shorter window or anything like that at all, and hopefully just kind of get yourself thinking about the answers, your own answers to those questions as well, just as like a gaming fan to like wonder back and, you know, realize like, oh, you know, I never thought about it that way. So yeah, it's just a short form, simple conversational podcast, just for gaming fans for sure.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, that 20 to 30 minute time frame is honestly a pretty good sweet spot, at least here in the Valley too. I mean, you got to figure it's 30 minutes from even here to go to most places, right? So like that's a nice kind of time frame to get started on your drive, pop on the podcast, and then just kind of hear and go. Whereas I think we're kind of a round trip type of podcast.
This one is that I'll start driving to work, I'll get through most of it, and then I'll usually on the back half is when I hear the ends of your episodes and everything. So, and that's fine, like it's totally fine, but usually, you know, I won't quite be home, the podcast will end and I have some time to kill. And how do I tackle that time? I want to make sure people have something in that time. So that was the focus.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right. Well, let's go into some of these articles, man. We don't have to spend a ton of time. I don't always like to spend like 30, 40 minutes on an article. But the first one here is 2024. Is it a chance of redemption for Xbox and Microsoft Gaming CEO Phil Spencer? So this is more kind of Phil Spencer-esque in a sense, like just kind of focused on him. But I want to kind of put this more towards the idea of Microsoft in general. And so this is Muhammad Ali Bari that wrote this one at Twisted Voxel. So we saw the list. You've got Hellblade. You've got, what is it?
Indiana Jones.
Indiana Jones, Senua. Well, not Hellblade. So it's Senua Saga. And then Starfield. And I think there was one other on there. Avowed was another one that they had.
Yeah.
So the idea here is like they've spent a crap ton of money on Bethesda and Activision acquiring all of these different studios. And what have they had to show for it?
Yeah.
Right? Like you've got things that haven't been released yet. We've been waiting for Senua for like 3 years now. Like that game should have been out. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think unless it already came out, I don't know. I don't keep up with Microsoft.
It
nowadays.
Is like out like very soon because I know I've seen some like Digital Foundry videos from a technology breakdown of it. So they either have review code or it's like just hitting for folks to get. So I know it is that one.
Yeah, soon. It's coming. That's when I'm going to get on PC. Right. And so I think that's part of this discussion. Right. Is Microsoft is putting so many of their eggs in all these different baskets. Whereas you look at companies like Sony, and it's like it's PlayStation first and foremost, and then they've had a couple instances where they've done like a day one release on PC like Helldivers, mm-hmm. which made sense given that what Helldivers is. But things like Spider-Man, God of War, like those have taken some time to actually hit PC and are getting good sales, but like if you want it right away, it's PlayStation. And then we already know all of these games are going to be on PC as well first day. So obviously Microsoft benefits in terms of OS and such if it's tied to that. So that makes sense, but the user base for PC is already so large as is. Is it a situation where like Microsoft 2024 Xbox is pretty much done, like, and moving forward, Xbox is finished and they're just kind of focused on putting out new games? Is there a redemption here for Microsoft and Xbox specifically? Personally, I don't think so. I can't see, like, they've had so many great games that they've put out or plan to put out. And it hasn't done anything for them, for the Xbox specifically. So is this year going to be any different? My thought is no.
Yeah, I mean, I would say so. I think from like, is this a redemption year for them? I don't know if it's a redemption year. I think that it's a year that they could have success. And that being said, because of the investment of you know, Switches, like, they're going to have a successor to that like soon. But people own a Switch and people own a PlayStation. Yes, a lot of people own an Xbox as well, but I think when people are thinking about spending their money and they realize there's not some AAA game coming from Sony or Nintendo, they might be willing to like, you know, maybe I'll buy an Xbox because like I'm a multi-platform household and I didn't get an Xbox One at all through the entire generation, but I've been eyeballing the Xbox, just maybe getting a Series X just because of it's the ecosystem it's building and being able to still buy original Xbox and 360 games. Like, I was thinking it would be nice to have one just for the access to some of that older content and things that I would like to go back and play, not necessarily current stuff. So I think they could have like potentially like a sales or an install base growth. But from a redemption standpoint, they're still in that weird, murky, like transitional period. They definitely are doing something major in the background that's evolving from a console or a singular console into like more of their brand. And like, you can play this wherever you'd like to play this, but do know this is an Xbox branded success or release or whatever it may be. So they still have to appease people who have invested in them at this point. But with the lineup that they have, it doesn't look that like enticing to like, oh my gosh, I have to go buy that Xbox for Indiana Jones. Like, this is going to change the way I game. Like, it's not the same. But that being said, what does Sony have this year? Like, they've already said there isn't a major title. There isn't going to be like a Last of Us level or Spider-Man level title from them. So like, it's hard to like, I don't want to say shame Microsoft, but like, you know, knock points from them if at the same time Nintendo doesn't have a Breath of the Wild and or a title of that scale, and Sony doesn't have a title of that scale. It's just this weird lull year that, you know, everybody's kind of experiencing. So yeah, how do they make up ground there? It's weird.
Yeah, and looking at Microsoft, I kind of see this as more of a decision year for them in a way, right? Like, where do we go from here? 2024, like if we sell Xboxes like gangbusters and we think, all right, cool, like we're actually making some progress here, maybe we change up the strategy and we release like a 60-day window only on Xbox and is delayed on PC, whatever it may be, right, to kind of amp up those sales. I think that's a decision year. And then from here, we kind of see what happens. I mean, I've talked about on a number of occasions, I know other people have too, on do they just ditch the hardware for for at home and start moving into mobile and doing things on PC only and having streaming on PlayStation and Nintendo and having access to all these titles. And we're kind of seeing that already happen with like Hi-Fi Rush mm-hmm. and other titles hitting competitor consoles. Is this a sign that they are done with hardware moving forward after this generation?
I think that's a move that somebody needs to do first to obviously see how that works out. And it would make sense unless they, because Sony and Microsoft have always invested heavily in the hardware side and have done it at a loss, from just the research and development of it to the actual like cost per unit during its initial sales window. Whereas Nintendo has always sold hardware, you know, not at a loss. They're still profiting in those regards. So unless they're going to release some budget-ish cost console to still play Xbox games on, which I can see them doing, but having like an app or a hub or some type of like digital storefront on other people's like platforms while selling their games, like, hey, subscribe to us or opt into this and you can have access to all these games, that can generate money in a subscription model, you know, for them too. But something's going to happen. And what's weird is they've acquired so many studios that are big, like you mentioned with Activision and
Bethesda.
They acquired like Obsidian and some like, you know, mid-tier, like, I love their games, so it's hard to really say they're mid-tier, but like there's a lot of other studios they've acquired over the years that we've yet to see their first original outputs as well as a Microsoft game studio. Because what is Outer Worlds and all stuff that was still that revolved around like a multi-platform contract and things. It was on multiple platforms.
And then the other one was Ninja Fury. That's what I was looking up now. Like Ninja Fury did Senua, right? Yeah. And then they did...
Senua started multi-platform with the first one there. And so then Microsoft acquired. So they were already like production and the idea of that sequel was probably happening before the Microsoft Game Studio like acquisition was like the decision made. So yeah, you've got to think about these other studios they've got working on things. Like, it's probably odd because they've maybe allowed for additional development time or whatever it may be, but 2025 could be a strong year for them because of like some solid like double A, you know, scale games with some triple A games catching up to them. If they have actively been like ensuring that their developments like for those games have been happening, if they've just dropped the ball and are really just like now in like a panic pivot of like, you know, they don't know what to do, it would be very crazy a business of that size to be in that nature of it. But I mean, I wouldn't put it past that being a possibility as well, because like it's just a weird time right now. Yeah,
I mean, it seems they've dropped the ball in a lot of instances over the last, well, really this generation, right? Mm-hmm. They've had a lot of stuff that they could be putting out, things are getting delayed, things aren't, you know, being put into that ecosystem, and now Sony's so far ahead, Nintendo's so far ahead with their install base, it's like, you know, and then of course you got PC, right? Yeah. So like there's, in the grand scheme of things, there is no reason to buy an Xbox.
Yeah.
If you've got a PC at home and you have the ability to put games on there and it can play those upscale games, and that's not even that expensive nowadays. You can get a good graphics card for $300-$400 and run a pretty good, you know, number of games.
Yeah.
So I think that window's closing for them as a whole. All right, the next thing I have here is parents share warning after her son spends $4,000 on video games. This was ABC, actually, and Elizabeth Schultz was the main reporter on this one. They don't actually call out the game, which is kind of disappointing, but I have a feeling it was like Fortnite or something, because it was like a younger kid, spent however much on cosmetics and weapons and things of that nature. I don't play Fortnite, but I would imagine that's...
Well, what could you buy? Like, unless he's buying multiple of the same, would there even be a marketplace of $4,000? Oh yeah, in-game currency.
In-game currency, that's it.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I can think of. And I'm just, how are we in 2024 and like we're still worried about kids jumping into digital wallets and buying thousands of dollars in games and parents like wishing for refunds? Like, you'd think that there would be enough education at this point. And also, like, you and I have kids, and we're at the age now where, like, I was a little later in my time period, but I have people that are, you know, my age that have 10 and 12-year-olds, and their kids are playing video games. They're not spending thousands of dollars. I mean, generationally, we grew up with video games. We understand a lot of those things that are occurring with, like, the digital currencies and wallets and all of that. How are these parents so out of the know?
I don't know. Like, I don't know what game that could be, like... There are so many built-in things. I have, my oldest is actually, she's 11. And so she's grown up with an iPad since she was like two or three. Like, she's been playing games and they're all like Roblox kids. And like, there are options for them there, but the game itself has built-in limitations for parental controls. Like being on an iPad or like the Apple ecosystem, we have like a family sharing setup with purchase limitations, request to buy, two-factor passwords. Like, there's so many layers of security and prevention from being able to do something like that, that not only are independent games and platforms making those things there, but the hardware themselves allows that to be. So I mean, I don't know how a family could be in this situation outside of trying to make an obscene, like, oh my gosh, we realize they spent 60. Let's just blow it out of proportion and try and get some attention. And maybe that will help our cause to get this refund back. But it's just, I don't know how you get in that situation this day and age. I don't know how you get in that situation a decade ago, even, because there was already ways to, like, advanced and protect yourself. But, like, yeah, that's just a crazy story that it's still happening.
Yeah, it's absurd. I mean, the only other thing I could think of is an additional step by gaming companies that, which they're not going to take, is to have like a tutorial for when things are set up for the family. Like if a parent is installing a game for their kid, you know, hey, here's two-factor authentication, here's security protocol, here's all these things. Or maybe the kid says, hey, I want to buy X item, you know, in my game. Okay, cool. Like, don't hand the kid the credit card, obviously. Like, that's step one, I think. Be present in that whole process, but then, like, understand, like, if you were putting your credit card information in, there has to be something in there that very much is like, okay, do you want to set up dual authentication? Do you want to have security passcodes? Do you want to have spend limits? Like, do you want to do all of these things?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I'm sure games have that. A number of them do, but are these parents just kind of like, yeah, you know, like, just out of touch with their kids and go on, here's my card, make your purchase, do what you need to do, and that's it, leave me alone type of thing. Like, maybe that's the situation here that led to something like this occurring.
Yeah, that's the only scenario I can think of where that has happened. Yeah, it's like an oblivious parent who, like, just greenlit of, like, sure, go ahead, you can use this one time, and then the kid adds it and, you know, does it all there. But, like, that just requires just, you know, the obliviousness and the ignorance to, like, even wanting to be involved at that point. And so I don't feel, like, too bad in that scenario for that household, because they kind of did it to themselves with not being just more aware and conscientious of what, like, their children were doing on the device. You know?
Yeah. And the article even mentions, like, other things that you could do, which is, like, give the kid a prepaid gift card and preload it with however many dollars. So if you have an allowance, like, hey, here's your credit card, here's what you put into the game, this is all set, I'll put in some money every now and then for allowance purposes. And that's what you got. Yeah. Right. Like, that's the right parenting approach right there. And it's not the knock on people as, like, bad parents, but, you know, be self-aware as to what the heck your kid's doing, especially in the digital age when there are digital currencies. Like, be in the know as to what the heck's actually happening. I would assume a majority of people that listen to this podcast already know these things, mm-hmm. And are probably agreeing with that as they're listening. But I don't know, maybe you're a parent or a young adult and you don't realize that that's a thing, and you preload it, you give it to your brother, sister, younger sibling, and you're like, here, go play, and they blow up your currency in that respect too. So I don't know, if you're listening, take a look at your settings on your game and make the right adjustments.
Help set the game up. Peek at those settings under the hood. Ensure that you feel comfortable and protected on that end.
Yeah. And then be involved in the kid's life with the games too, right? Yeah. So, I mean, it's fun. It's fun stuff. My favorite article here that we're going to talk about. Tomb Raider's Lara Croft has been named the most iconic video game character of all time by BAFTA voters. This is Euronews, and it is David Morrigard that wrote this one. I saw the headline. I was like, what? Like, what's going on here?
Yeah, I think we both acknowledged the same thing, the same detail once we saw what the list was. It was very heavily weighted or in a certain region is what it appeared to be. And then looking further into it, yeah.
So the poll took 4,000 game players. Well, it says 4,000 players worldwide have voted in the BAFTA Game Awards. I would probably say it's probably heavily leaning towards British voters because it's a British organization. Even though it's a worldwide poll. The one thing I will point out here in the article, too, is it says Pikachu instead of Pikahu. So I'm kind of concerned by the author and their selection of making fun of Pikachu. And Pikachu, I don't even know. We'll have to look at the list here. We'll go 1 through 20 and tell people about the list. But yeah, so 4,000 people were surveyed, and it came out Lara Croft number one. Darren and I, with that detail, like we said, it's British voters. It makes sense. Lara Croft is based out of England. Cool. The other one that kind of initially surprised us was at number three, Agent 47. Again, makes sense.
Yeah,
James
European,
Bond.
Yeah,
Hitman. Sorry,
Hitman. Yeah, Hitman. Yeah, the developers from Europe, and the character itself, though, because I saw some online, you know, people like speculating about like how it's ridiculous that Agent 47 would be that high, but it is crazy that he is that high. But it's been a series that has been around for decades. It has had a rebooted franchise. It rebooted the franchise with a really awesome refresh that had a trilogy of games that have all been great. And there's been two movies as well. So it is not like it's an unknown property that shouldn't be on the list, period. Should it be above some of these other characters? Maybe not in my opinion, but clearly 4,000 voters have decided so.
Yeah, and the other one that surprised me was Sackboy of Little Big Planet hitting number 5 above Pac-Man and Zelda. you know, again, though, Media Molecule, it makes sense, right? British voters are going to acknowledge a British organization that's going to, you know, be in the top five, yeah. I would figure. But just going down the list real quick, you got Lara Croft, Mario at number two, Agent 47, Sonic, Sackboy, Pac-Man, Link, Master Chief, Kratos, Shadowheart from Baldur's Gate 3, Arthur Morgan, Pikachu at 12. That, to me, is surprising. Some of these are above Pikachu of all. Yeah. Steve from Minecraft. The voters probably weren't in that Minecraft age, I'm going to guess, to have participated. That might be why Steve is so low. But like, even I know Steve, right? Yeah. So you had Solid Snake coming at 14, Crash Bandicoot, Cloud at 16, Astreon of Baldur's Gate 3. So we got two from there. Kazuma Kiryu of Yakuza, Ellie Williams of Last of Us, and at number 20, Nathan Drake. So personally, I don't agree with this list. You know, when I look at Iconic, I'm thinking Mario for sure is number one, Sonic, Pac-Man, probably followed by, or actually Pikachu probably in the top three, Crash Bandicoot, and then the rest of them, I think you could probably free-for-all,
yeah,
in placement.
I mean, there's some that have been around for a long time that I think, like a Dragon Quest Slime, you know, or like Bomberman, like those are like branding wise, like they're, you can see them and know like exactly who they are. Like even if you haven't played a game, you probably recognize them. So like it should have some weight there. It's kind of odd that some of those names aren't on that list versus the Baldur's Gate 3 characters. There's two of them. I really want to play the game. Still haven't played it. I saw those names and I'm like, who are these characters? Oh, okay. Good for them. But that's a very recent release to be on a most iconic of all time ranking.
Yeah, I agree with that too. Like, I can see Uncharted for sure and Last of Us because those games were PS3 era games. We're looking at, what, 15 years ago, roughly,
yeah,
I
think, yeah, when they came out. A couple generations and re-releases and, you know,
yeah,
three times re-released.
They're over a decade ago, right? So, like, that could probably fit into, like, iconic games. Even, you know, even Master Chief and God of War, like, all of those are older games. Like, it makes sense for them to be on there. But, yeah, you're completely right. Like, Baldur's Gate 3 to me, even Red Redemption 2, I mean, it was a little early on to start being, like, most iconic. But you know, they're good characters, mm-hmm, you know, from what I've seen.
Oh, yeah.
So it makes,
yeah,
sense. It's just there. It almost feels like there should have been like a time period, not like over the last two decades, but over certain decades, mm-hmm, certain time frame within that period of time. So yeah, that's, yeah, that would be my only argument here, but overall it's a pretty cool list. And kind of happy to see Lara Croft there, cause that was originally like some PlayStation stuff, right?
Yeah.
With,
yeah,
Eidos and took over Mario in the BAFTA Awards thing. So, I mean, yeah, somebody dethroned Mario as number one, and it was Lara Croft of all characters.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So, yeah. Well, let's go into our last piece here for the episode, and that is on our inflation deflation. So we played The City of Lost Children. It was developed by Cynosis. It was published by Cynosis, directed by Dennis Friedman, released in April of 1997. See, I told you I remembered a year. It is an adventure game with a reception of around 4 to 5 out of 10. So overall, the synopsis here for this, which came from a wiki, is strange things happen at night in a gloomy port city. Strange individuals with a mechanical eye kidnap children and take them away, loading them onto trucks. Among them are also Denray, the little brother of One, a dumb but good kid who performs the number of strongman at the circus. Meanwhile, Mayette, a 12-year-old orphan, is forced to steal from the directress of the orphanage where she lives. In a pieuvre, I'm guessing, or pieuvre? I don't know. I'm not French. And I think that's where it takes place. During her thefts, she runs into One, who begs her to help him find his little brother. Mayette then decides to help him and find out what happens to the children who are kidnapped before it's too late. This game, you know, you had mentioned that you watched some YouTube videos to get more of a deep end analysis on like the sound quality and like the visuals and kind of hear some commentary and things of that nature. And I went through and played this last night, and I would say this might be one of the clunkiest games I've ever played on the PlayStation. And I've played some clunky stuff. I think we played Kingsley's Adventure a while back. I don't know, mm-hmm, if you're familiar with that one at all. That game was super clunky. This was worse, in my opinion. I mean, we're talking, you know, you know how some games, if you run into a wall, you can kind of still glide and keep going? No, you run into a wall, she's like, oh, and she stops, and you pause, and you wait. And I go, okay, let me turn my character 10 degrees with just my D-pad, because there's no analog support in this game. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of stuck on that regard. You can run, which is cool, but the overall clunky nature of this game, to me, was horrendous. I mean, we're talking slow paced, trying to, if you're trying to go across like a board that's, you know, over a piece of water, you're like just having to angle it right to where you can step over that board. And if you misstep in any way, she's like, whoa, like loses her balance and then like stays put. And you got to redirect again to make your pain in the ass process. Any sort of commands that you do have in the game. So if you were actively, you know, trying to talk to a certain character, if you were not facing them directly and you press the talk button, either nothing happens or she says, I can't manage. Hence the title of our beginning here. Or this is something I can't manage, or I can't manage this. And it just goes on and on with that. And then the other thing that I know you're going to kind of talk about a little bit too is items. The way that this game is structured is very puzzle-esque. So as it stated, you're doing like these small robberies and such. So to kind of open up the game, you start within this orphanage classroom and you have two directors or two twins that are directors of this orphanage.
Speaking in unison and in creepy voiceover or voice acting.
But yeah. It was very creepy. I was like, I took a step away for a moment because I was doing something in the kitchen while the game was loading up. And I heard the voices. I'm like, what the hell is this? Like, I thought it was like supposed to be an orphanage or something. And I look, I'm like, that's super creepy.
Yeah.
And the way they're just kind of like right next to each other talking at all times. So you're told to go rob a hut. I forget which hut it is, but it's a hut for somebody. And that's all you're told, right? What the game doesn't tell you is if you talk to the two orphanage directors, they will tell you, oh, so-and-so has a key. And that'll get you into the hut. Okay, cool. Well, I didn't know that when I first started. I was like, okay, well, I'll just go out the door. She told me I got to rob something, so I'm going to go that way. They don't give you any indication as to where it is. So you got that going for you. The guy that has the key, unless you ask the two directors, like, hey, does so-and-so have the key? They don't tell you. So when you go to this guy, he just says, scat, move along. I don't want to talk to you. There's no indication of a key for stealing. That's it. He's like, no, go do your thing. I'm not involved in it, blah, blah. So then you're trying to find your way to this hut, which you have no idea where it is. And then good luck finding items to help you support, because unless you were like directly over the item, it doesn't appear. And so that's a pain in the ass. And then of course the clunky nature of the puzzles. So the one example is the puzzle when you are the idea after I read a guide, cause I was just so sick of it. You're supposed to go to a lighthouse. You're supposed to throw a piece of metal pipe onto an electrical panel. It bursts the light out. The guy who's watching the hut, the night guard, says, oh, what the hell's that? It must be that kid. You hide. He messes with whatever it is. You make your way to the hut. You steal, and you kind of go from there, right? That's the overall idea in the puzzle. How in the world I would ever have figured out as a kid during 1997 is beyond me. Without true guides and video support and things of that nature, there's no way I would have got. Even today, I had to look it up because I'm like, I just can't sit through this game and go through these puzzles.
Yeah.
Right?
It's like a... I mean, it's definitely of its era, that game design adventure game feel. It's like a LucasArts like point and click kind of adventure game, but just giving you the option to like freely roam around and have control. It was like, in my mind, I feel like they think it was successful, or they think it was a great, you know, step forward for that genre because it was adding more technology to like that type of design. But really, it's like, to try and describe how that type of game is, it's like feeling around a room you're not familiar with in the dark. Like you literally just like, can I feel for a doorway or a window or something to get through? Like, or what are my limitations here? You know, what do I need to find? Like to really play this game in a completely unknown, guideless world, like you would literally just run until you came across a locked door, a dead end, a corridor, and then just kind of continue to run around. Just kind of like outlining in your brain, what are my limitations? I can only go in these kind of three areas right now. So I must have to find an item now. So then you're looking for an item, a sponge or a metal bar or whatever it may be. I don't directly know the context for this, but I apparently have to have this. So then it's kind of like let me try this random item at this random location or with this character in hopes it does something different. So it's really just fumbling about to try and unlock it. And yes, narratively, they want you to like discover those things. But like you said, without exhausting conversation options or without revisiting some of the characters in passing that you thought maybe their one phrase was enough, you didn't realize you can talk to them maybe multiple times. It's clunky kind of game design. It's clunky controls with clunky game design and how you kind of advance and continue to grow through it. So For sure of its era. It just modern me would not be able to handle that.
Well, and like the graphics in the game, I think are actually quite nice.
Yeah.
For that type of, like, I actually was very impressed with what I was looking at graphically, and the music isn't terrible with the background ambiance that you have. Like, all of that's kind of nice. But to your point, like, it's clunky controls, clunky game design, and then even the example I brought up on that first puzzle, like, if you don't talk to the directress or whatever, say, hey, you know, what's happening? Like, how do I get in? How do I do this? You wouldn't know to go to this guy and ask for a key, right? And so beyond that, he's the only individual that you would talk to other than, like, the night watchman. And all he says is, hey, you're trespassing. I'm going to throw you in the warehouse if you continue trespassing. And then so coincidentally, I threw the metal pipe at the lighthouse thing, got it done, but I didn't hide because I was like, oh, okay, like, I've got plenty of time because this dude is way across on the other end of his harbor. I got plenty of time to make my way through, walk underneath, and avoid him. No, I didn't. He catches me, throws me in a warehouse, which is now a totally new puzzle. I happen to have a bottle on me, okay? Mm-hmm. And the character that's in the warehouse is a drunk guy, and he's, like, talking about a bottle and talking about his brother or, like, the night watchman, whatever it is. I'm thinking, okay, I don't see any doors to get through. I see some boxes I can climb on, but no window that's accessible to me. I do see a switch to open the door, but it's not working. And this guy's talking about a bottle constantly. Maybe I give him the bottle I have. Maybe he does something. No.
No.
You just set it in front of him. And that was it. Like, nothing happened. So I was like, it was just beyond me, like, what to do. So to your point, guideless world, you know, even today, it's a tough game. Just not the best of puzzles.
Yeah. And it only grows, like as you progress further. Like, if you figure out a puzzle, what your reward is an additional area that you then have to kind of mentally map out. Like, where are my limitations here? How many new characters are here? Are there some items I'm going to stumble across that I may need to, like, dog ear in the back of my brain to, like, think about? But it's just finding that combination of the person, item, and place within the boundaries that you have, and then wash, rinse, and repeat. But it just keeps growing bigger and making it more and more confusing about, wait, now where do I go? Like, this is too deep of a pool. Like, I am confused here.
And I've got this brush that I picked up, like, 20 areas ago, and now can I use it here? Can I not? Like, and then, yeah, to your point, you didn't find yourself, like, putting random items in certain places to see if it actually works or not, because there's no guidance.
Yeah.
And maybe there is guidance down the road. Maybe you play 10 hours in, and you're like, okay, cool, like, I've got fully understand what's happening here, the controls feel better, like, maybe after a certain period of time the game does grow on you and you get used to it. But in the hour or so that I spent playing it last night, dude, I was like, I'm done.
Yeah,
like,
I can't keep playing an hour. This. I mean, I think it's more than I would have been able to get if I physically, you know, got my hands on it. I don't want to, like, insult the game or anything. It definitely, I think it just is an adventure game of its era for sure. I think fans would have liked it. I mean, it's actually based on a movie, and it's a very obscure movie. As a kid growing up, I remember my brother, like, loving this, but he really liked weird stuff. Like, he's where I, like, gotten, like, punk music and all that stuff was from him. So he always knew weird things. H.R. Giger artwork.
It's got Ron Perlman, like, all these
weird things. Yeah. Like, he's got interesting, like, connections of, like, strange things. So that's just, whenever I hear of this, I think of him. But I personally never saw it, but I just knew it's got, like, a cult status, and people love it for what it was. So having this game time. And then the pros to it, I think, like you mentioned, the visuals, it does look great. It's got pre-rendered backgrounds that are really, like, ambient and moody. Because of the saving the resources and using pre-rendered backgrounds, the character models and the polygons, like, that they do use are pretty, like, uniquely shaped and detailed. And then all that voice acting, like, it wasn't common to have, like, you know, everybody voice acted and having the whole story, like, narrated and things like that to you. So for the amount of voice work in it, you know, definitely a PlayStation title. You couldn't do that on a cartridge or anything back in that time. So
yeah, it's kinda for sure. Cool. Yeah, no, I thought it was a pretty cool game overall. And that world. The world itself of City of Lost Children is actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
When you're in that, like, I wouldn't say, it's like a dystopian type of area, right? And, like, just all these rusted pieces of metal everywhere. Obviously, no money flowing around. Like, there's obviously a night watch guard for a hut that happens to have money, and it's very empty, like an empty world in general from what we were playing or what I was playing last night. So I think it's cool. It's usually right up my alley in terms of, like, in that type of world, right? I love those, like, post-apocalyptic dystopian type stuff. Like, I love those types of worlds and those types of stories. This for me obviously wasn't my cup of tea, and I think a lot of it stems from the negatives that we mentioned. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that are cool about it, and it might be worth checking out if you've never heard of it or you find that type of stuff to be of interest. But overall, you know, we'll get into some brass tacks here. So a complete in box copy is going to run you $147.50. I mean, so after everything we've talked about, are you willing to pick it up for $147.50 complete in box? Likelihood is no. That peaked actually at $226 in April of 2022 when all video games spiked in price. So this one, of course, spiked accordingly. The price on that at $147 is holding pretty steady. A loose copy right now would run you $69.34. That peaked at $100 in, again, 2022. It is kind of keeping a steady trend as well. There are cheaper versions. If you want a disc version of this on PC, so you have an older PC, has a drive, all that good stuff, you can pick it up for like $5. And then PAL versions are anywhere from like 20 loose to 40 complete in box. Same with PC, under 40. So there are some affordable ways to play this game. And of course, there are preservation-based devices. That's what we like to call them here, where you can go ahead and play that in a different manner. So yeah, I think overall, I would say this title is heavily inflated.
Yeah, it's obscure, it's neat, it's interesting as a whole picture and package, but I don't think you can justify wanting to buy it for that cost for what it is and what you're going
to
get.
Care to hear what I got it for?
Yeah.
$5.
$5.
At a Goodwill.
How long ago?
4 years ago.
4 years ago, wow.
So it was still $80 back then.
Wow. That's a good lucky find.
Not complete in box, though. So funny enough, it was one of those situations where I was going through the CDs. It has a manual. It doesn't have the back art. So I was going through some CDs, and it's kind of laying on its side. And I saw City of Lost. And I saw the eyeball on the logo. I'm like, what the hell is this? So I grabbed it, looked in. I'm like, well, there's a game in here, but it's a Metallica CD back. I'm like, so that's kind of interesting. But I was like, all right, well, I guess I'll buy it. You know, it's like $5 for that game. Might have been less, actually. And got home. Looked it up, just kind of get an idea of like what the heck it was, if it had any price value to it. And yeah, I saw like $80 for like a loose copy back then. I was like, that's pretty crazy. Find.
I try and shop around like that. I don't commit to it and do it like, you know, monthly or anything at all. But like, I always dream of being able to walk into a place and find that deal. I'm like, oh my gosh, you guys don't realize you have X, Y, or Z. Like, I got it for a deal. I never stumble across those things.
This Goodwill by us, dude, used to be solid. Like, I'd go in there and find tons and tons and tons of games all the time, like good stuff at cheap prices. I don't even think they carry games anymore. Like the last 5-6 times I've been there over the last several months, zero. Like not even a Wii Fit, like nothing, no controls, no. So I think they've moved. They were already actively transitioning things to online sales as is. And so I think they moved all of our video games to online sales.
Interesting. Yeah, I was waiting on a prescription to fill maybe a month or so ago. And I did go in there. I did find Viz put out those Nintendo Power Super Mario comics like in a, a collection. And the Scott McCloud like how-to comics thing. It's kind of a famous like comic how-to book. But I found a couple things. And a Calvin and Hobbes book. I'm like, oh, maybe one of my kids will like this. So for like, you know, $7, I got these three books. I'm like, hey, this is a steal. Like, to me, like, this is what I hope to, like, walk in and find some things. I always want to find video games or electronics like that, but I never do, so.
I remember one time I went in there. I think I talked to Brian about this one. So I went in one day, and it was a couple minutes after I was playing. Like, I left the house 2 minutes late type of deal. I'm like, all right, like, time frame I wanted to go. And I was standing there, and this guy's like, oh, look what I found. He was looking for games, and it's Mario Thousand Year Door for, like, $4. I'm like, geez. I'm like, that's insane. And he was, like, so excited. I looked down below. Tons of Dragon Ball Z games on PlayStation 3, Ratchet and Clank games, all stuff. I'm like, just took the whole stack. Yeah. I was like, all right, well, you have a good day, man. Like,
enjoy your game.
Like, enjoy your game. I'll take these like 20 games that are probably worth double what you just grabbed, you know? Cause I was like, and there's a lot of cool games I didn't have. So I kept all those DBZ games cause I just didn't have them. So you saw the collection that it gets built into that. And yeah, it was funny because like the guy was so excited about that one game that he found that he didn't realize the like hundreds of dollars in games that they had just put out right underneath him. It's like,
that's a good find.
Yeah, that's a good find. But like, it's so, so rare. And then there's so much competition. Like, I'm telling you all of this, right? And there are guys that'll go in there who like they time it out just perfect or used to. I don't know if they still do, where they would go in and they would just with a cart. They would wait until they brought the stuff out and they would yank it all off of the carts as they were coming out. So like there was one guy, like I think he had friends in the back at that location. So they would tell him like, oh, we got X items coming out at this time type of thing. So like, unless I beat like that one particular guy, there was nothing I was going to get.
Yeah.
So I remember coming in one time and a guy like stacks of Nintendo DS and 360 games in his cart. so pissed.
Yeah, last year there, I pulling in here, I saw there's the community yard sale. I forgot that they were doing it this weekend.
I did it today.
Oh,
garbage. Nothing. Oh.
We found a neighbor on the south side, and my wife, this was sometime last year, it could have been 2 years ago, but like inbox copies of like Game Boy Advance and some older games and all that stuff, but like complete like Castlevania, Aria of Sorrow, and like Final Fantasy Tactics on PS1, and like some really cool things, $5 each, you know? So I said, he's like, oh, they have some loose manuals. I was like, you know what? Anything it sounds like they have there, if it's for like a few bucks or whatever, just spend $50 on whatever they've got, and like I'm sure that, you know, we could do something with it. I ended up wanting all of it. I've kept all that stuff, and like it's just kind of cool, like little relics and retro things that like I have. But that was like the one time I've ever like been involved, and that was just because my wife decided to just call, like, hey, do you want any of this stuff? And I was like, yes, please, like, always keep an eye out for old gaming stuff. I like to look at that, and I want it for sure.
Yeah, and that's one of the cool things about like hunting games, and like in that instance, City of Lost Children, is like you never know what you're going to come across, and there's some like random stuff out there that you pick it up and you're like, oh, that's interesting, like I'll grab it because it happens to be PlayStation, happens to be Nintendo. And then you get home and you're like, oh wow, this is actually value, but there's a story behind it too. Like if I didn't buy that game, I would probably never know what the hell City of Lost Children is. I would have never checked out the movie and known him Ron Perlman was in it. I would have known any of that, right? And like this whole new world is opened up from just finding that one game.
Yeah, that's cool,
you know. So yeah, it's pretty cool. All right, well, I think we're both in agreement. This game is inflated at its price point. So if you want those cheaper copies, PC, PAL, that's the way to go for sure. And then obviously other methods if you want to go about it that way to play it. So definitely appreciate you coming on this week. Do you want to remind folks where to find you and podcast name as well?
At Darren Hupke and at 32-Bit Library are like the social media handles. My books, they are on Amazon, volume 1, 2, and 3. But they're also available on retrogamebooks.com. I know you had Brian on a couple weeks ago, Rad Dude. He's been on my new podcast as well. But retrogamebooks.com has a bunch of really cool original books that he's done. But he's now expanded and started to carry books from other creators, and has been interested enough to kind of carry my books. So if you buy them through that website, I have like stickers and trading cards and things like that that I sent up to him. So if you don't support like the really big giant corporation who makes it easy for you to buy, and you buy from, you know, like a small business of an actual gamer of like a really interesting person, you'll get some bonus and extras at no extra cost. So that's my preferred way for you to buy it. It may make sense internationally because the Amazon option is like a print on demand type of thing. You can, you know, in Europe, you can buy it and get it really cheap because shipping will be local compared to what it would be to ship it overseas.
That's pretty cool. I didn't know they did that.
Yeah. That's the their service has been like really convenient and really awesome. It makes it a quick turnaround time for me if I needed like author copies for conventions or for like the Game On Expo and stuff. So I think it's great that it's there. It's just, you know, the Amazon machine of it all.
Yeah. Well, and if you're here with us to the end of the episode, our interview with Brian Rigsby is episode 278. So definitely check that out. And you can hear a little bit more about some of the video game book publishing process and all that. We go into a little bit more detail on that and some of Brian's works. So all of that said, this has been episode 281 of the Game of Flavors podcast. My name is John, and I've been joined by Darren Hupke of 32-Bit Library. Thanks for listening.